I started out in documentary filmmaking after working as a lawyer and political consultant, making my first documentary about baseball around 2000. And then I began focusing on topics near and dear to my extended family's heart back in Iowa. My parents are from Western Iowa, Ottawa County, just south of a town some people may have heard of, Templeton, where famous bootleg whiskey Templeton Rye comes from. And I made my next documentary, Whiskey Cookers, the amazing true story of the Templeton Rye bootleggers, that was sponsored in part by Humanities Iowa, which was not about the present company, but about the 1920 story, and in fact about the community of German Catholics and Prohibition and so forth. The film I most recently completed is about the Iowa State Penitentiary. It's entitled The Fort, 177 Years of Crime and Punishment at the Iowa State Penitentiary, the oldest prison west of the Mississippi that was just shut down. They moved 500 maximum security inmates to a new facility 1 mile to the north, including one inmate who has been in prison since 1956, who is a major focus of the film. He is at once a figure who is not very sympathetic because he killed a policeman back in 1956. At the same time, at the age of 80 and after 62 years of incarceration, he's a thoroughly institutionalized old man. So it's a rather complex portrait. So in any event, I have found that the documentary opportunities in the Midwest, and to be absolutely as fertile as the soil of the Midwest. Mm. And in fact, after going through some of the deeds to our family farm, which has been in the family since 1879, I've been amazed at the history just in the abstracts and the deeds, the original government warrant from, I believe it was President Grant, to veterans of the War of 1812. It was a military grant. And to the veterans of the Creek War. And I thought, wow, there's some really interesting history here. The next county to the north, there was a farm owned by Abraham Lincoln for his service in the Black Hawk War. It got me more and more interested in the history of the Midwest. That got me doing some research and came across some of the books of John Lauck, who I'm developing this documentary with, your own local historian and national historian here in Sioux Falls. So now we're working on and developing this new documentary, The Midwest, How the Heartland Made America.
Give me an idea, first, why documentaries in the first place? What drew you to that that medium?
I was born in Los Angeles and grew up literally riding my bike on the back lot of the UCLA Film School, and spent many hours in the Fox Theater and the Bruin Theater in Westwood, West Los Angeles. So when most kids were reading The Cat in the Hat and so forth, I was reading Dr. Seuss, but I also, at a very young age, was very influenced by film and by some documentaries as well. I was not drawn to entertainment. My family moved east to Washington, D.C., and that gave me a real appreciation of history at a young age. I did my college work at Duke University in the South, a mile away from where the last army of the Confederacy surrendered to General Sherman, which gave me, after a year of studying the Civil War, gave me a deeper appreciation of history. And so between growing up in the cradle of motion pictures and Hollywood, also coming of age in the land of history and politics. It was sort of a natural progression to be drawn to documentary film. I didn't think I could make a career of it, and that's why I was sort of rather late to the career. I worked in other forms. It was only when the digital revolution came along and allowed independent filmmaking, thanks to digital cameras, laptop editing, and so forth, where I was really able to strike out on my own and make my first documentary successfully as an independent filmmaker, that I decided to take the leap and start a second career as a documentary filmmaker.
You must have a theory about why it's such fertile soil here in the Midwest to find topics that nobody's addressed yet or to talk about this region in documentary film. What are your thoughts for why it's so ripe for folks to come in and create something new that hasn't been done before?
There are a whole bunch of reasons, certainly. But I think one of the big ones, in addition to some of the parochialism, not of folks in the Midwest, but the parochialism of the folks in on the coasts, in Los Angeles, where they barely realize that there's anything other than Hawaii in Europe, or the parochialism of New Yorkers, who there's that famous cover from the New Yorker, a New Yorker view of the world, where they see New Jersey, they see Florida, they see San Francisco in the distance, and that's it. That's the entire extent. There's that parochialism. But another important element of it is on my mother's side, I'm part Norwegian, as are, of course, so many folks in this region. And there is, of course, that what's called from Scandinavia, Janteloven, that Scandinavian and more generally Midwestern self-effacing approach to life. You know, don't stick out. Don't call attention to yourself. Don't call undue attention. I think there has not been sort of the arrogant celebration of the region the way that some other cities or regions celebrate themselves. There also hasn't been the regional trauma, for instance, of the South the Civil War, which still echoes. So there are various reasons. But as a result, some elitists will refer to as flyover country has become flyover history. We have some very interesting, very important episodes from American history that we're very, very excited to rediscover with Midwesterners and all Americans.
Tell me about finding John Locke and what you read first that made you think this is the person that I need to connect with, and to the point where you're willing to get on a plane and come out and sit down and eat dinner with him and talk business.
I mentioned there are a number of digital tools that allowed somebody without a film degree background and so forth to make the leap and become a documentary filmmaker, one who's actually been able to win some awards and get on PBS and so forth mid-career. One is called Amazon. I jumped on and I typed doing research about the Midwest, and I came across John's book, The Lost Region. And it was like finding somebody speaking my exact language. It was an absolute aha moment to realize there was somebody who had identified an exact issue that I had been stewing about, frankly. It was very funny because for some time I was strategizing and talking to some professors who knew John about how to get in touch with him. And then we actually connected via Twitter social media, since he does such a good job of connecting people that way. And we had some phone conversations. Doing a film project is a major undertaking. It's something I'm looking forward to tackling in a lot of respects. But to the extent that the American to the Midwest Historical Association and others might be interested, that and some of John's resources and social network might be interested in participating, it was important for us to meet. So it was just exciting to come across his books, and very important for us to meet and talk about working on this together.
It's happened very often, John, where somebody reads something and gives you a call and says, "You are speaking my language. Let's talk."
Well, it's always a great day when that happens, and it sort of validates all the work you do at midnight in your basement, putting in all those footnotes and reading that next book. And pretty soon 5 years have gone by, but you get the book out the door, and it's always great to hear that someone on the other end identifies with it, and it leads to other projects.
All right. So is he right that Midwestern history is just waiting for more people to write about it and do projects like a documentary film about?
Yes, he is right. For everything, there is a season, as they say. And this is the Midwest moment, I think, to get more attention. And I think we've got some momentum. I know that there are a couple other books in the pipeline about the Midwest that'll be coming in the next few years. And I think we've got a lot of momentum at the Midwestern History Association. The natural next step is one of these Ken Burns style documentaries about the Midwest. And I know that's what Dan is thinking about. And he's the perfect person to do it because he knows a lot about the region.
So there's a sense of epicness about it. You're not necessarily thinking small. You're thinking a documentary series, not just a one-hour documentary about the Midwest.
Yes. One of John's favorite historians to invoke is Frederick Jackson Turner, who said, I forget what the quote is, but it essentially was, go big or go home, whatever the 1900s version of that would be. Yes, there's too much to cover. This would be a documentary series, probably along the lines of a four-episode series, probably one-hour shows, so maybe 4 hours total. And I'd love to give you a few examples of that I think would surprise your listeners.
Let's dig into that. Why, what makes it hold up? So where should we begin?
Well, I think people would be surprised to know just how important the Midwest was to the American Revolution. You think the American Revolution, you think the Boston Tea Party. You might think of Yorktown in Virginia. If you really know your history, you might be aware of the campaigns in South Carolina. But in fact, when Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia, in his Bill of Particulars, after he declared that all men were created equal and endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights, there were, of course, that long list of grievances that the colonists, then colonists, although I guess at that time they were American, they were declaring their independence, so they were Americans. The grievances that the Americans were stating. One of the most essential ones that he and the Americans stated, and let me just read this to you. One of their biggest grievances against King George III was, he has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, i.e. to the west, across the Appalachians into the Ohio Valley, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. Again, blocking the acquisition of land into what we really would consider the eastern Midwest, the Ohio Valley, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and so forth, which coincidentally, Ben Franklin, George Washington, the Jefferson family, all had invested, all were speculators and investors in the Ohio Valley Company. So that was a substantial motivating force, especially for the Virginians, because Virginia laid claim substantially to the Ohio Valley. So that was very much on their mind.
They're essentially businessmen, and the crown is keeping them.
Correct. Not only
from
businessmen,
pursuing their business interests.
Not only businessmen. It was also they felt they had earned it with their blood, because in the French and Indian War, when George Washington first drew his sword as a soldier in 1763 at what they called the Forks of the Ohio, what is now Pittsburgh, they fought and were promised land in exchange for their service to the king. Now, at the peace treaty and thereafter, when they won all that land from the French, the Ohio Valley, the English then made a decision, well, we want to keep the Indians at bay, so colonists, you're going to stay east of the Appalachian Mountains. And then Washington and the others said, wait a minute, you had promised us land, the western lands. You know, that's part of why we fought this war. That's part of why many of our brothers died fighting this war. So they felt double-crossed, not just as businessmen, but as soldiers, frontiersmen, and so forth. Another example of how the Midwest figured in the Revolutionary War, and this is incredibly overlooked, it was a major theater for the war. There were significant battles, certainly strategically, maybe not in quite the scope as far as numbers of troops and so forth, but there was a significant battle of St. Louis. And then George Rogers Clark, brother of William Clark, the explorer, the famous explorer of the later Corps of Discovery, overcame the British in the Illinois country and in Indiana. By doing that, the Americans, specifically led by Benjamin Franklin, were able to insist that they receive all of the land west of the Appalachians all the way to the Mississippi River. If George Rogers Clark had not done so, if the British had not been defeated at those battles, then the colonists, the Americans, could easily have simply been a nation of the Eastern Seaboard. Mm. It could simply have been the Appalachians to the coast, and we could have simply been a coastal nation. Instead, when the guns fell silent, it was a pretty sizable nation that went all the way to the Mississippi River. Mm. So that's one example.
John, how does Ben Franklin know what's out there? Has this been mapped? Is this, you know, what has the exploration been like up until this point?
Well, there were reports back from the fur traders and some of the early settlers who were bumping up against the Appalachian Mountains. And there was an expectation of what the future of this region would be. And all of that came to fruition in the Northwest Ordinance, which I bet Dan was going to talk about here in a minute, which is too often forgotten. But at the same time that the Constitution was being framed down in Philadelphia, the Continental Congress was meeting and passing the Northwest Ordinance, which was this piece of legislation that would govern how the early Midwest would be shaped and formed. And it made absolutely critical decisions about the future of the region, such as there would be no slavery in the Midwest, that there would be a heavy emphasis on democratic government, there'd be a heavy emphasis on education for everyone. Because prior to this, of course, mostly only aristocrats were educated. Most everyone else was a peasant. And so they set up a whole new order of things in the Midwest, which made it quite distinct from what the Eastern Seaboard was. Because remember, the Eastern Seaboard, even though there were revolutionaries there and they broke away from England, it was still heavily aristocratic, heavily governed by landed estates and the gentry. But the Midwest was going to be a different place.
And heavily slave.
So before we go on, though, I feel like anytime we have these conversations, at some point, it's difficult not to address the indigenous people who already lived here, the people who are getting slaughtered and shoved off their land. How do you put this in the context of what they were thinking at the time?
They were obviously a very important part of this story and an absolutely essential part of the French and Indian War and the American Revolution. And they were very active participants in this history and very savvy about who they decided to ally themselves with and break away from. Basically, the French and Indian War, in many ways, was a war of shifting alliances. Who could get the various tribes to be on their side for a certain amount of time, long enough to win the conflict? So they were very important pieces of this history. And they would be throughout the first couple of decades of American history. I mean, the first major foreign policy struggles of the Washington administration and the Adams administration were these battles out in Ohio against the tribes who are trying to prevent the American settlers from moving in. So again, that makes Dan's point about how the Midwest ended up at the center of all this history.
You actually anticipated one of the next important events, and that is the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. Most Americans don't realize that there was a war that for quite a while where Native Americans were fighting the Army of the United States and beating them in battle after battle after battle. When the War of 1812 was fought, the British handled a number of the forts up on the Canadian border, and of course the naval fights, but they supplied their native allies and had them launch fights at Fort Madison in what is now Iowa, at, I believe, Prairie du Chien, and in other forts along the Mississippi River. And in almost all of them, the Americans wound up abandoning those positions to leaders like Black Hawk and others. It was an unmitigated disaster on the Northwest border. And of course, that was also the war where Tecumseh and the Indian Confederacy tried and for a time successfully organized and mounted the best, last organized resistance as a unified Indian front to resist American encroachment. Ultimately, Tecumseh was killed at the Battle of the Thames, I believe it was, in Canada. That perhaps was the biggest blow in the history of the struggle to the Native people stopping the encroachment of the Americans westward. And most Americans have no idea for quite a while the U.S. was on its heels in the face of the Indian advances.
You mentioned slavery, not, you know, plans to keep slavery out of the Midwest. So I feel like we should maybe jump ahead a little bit and talk about the Civil War and the role of the Midwest in that conflict.
I think people are going to be very surprised to find out that the Civil War was not caused by an attack on Fort Sumter. It was not caused by secession per se. But I very much would argue that the Civil War was really caused by the Midwest, by and large, or at least many of the controversies that led to the Civil War really weren't about slavery in the South or freedom in the North, but really about slavery and the extension of slavery into the territories and into the Midwest territories. First, John mentioned the Northwest Ordinance, or I would almost call it the Midwest Constitution. It was contemporaneous with the Constitution, and of all people, it was Thomas Jefferson who advocated that slavery be banned from the territories. He's pilloried these days for owning slaves, and understandably, lots of our leaders have clay feet and some hypocritical skeletons in their closet, but he's due some credit for being an advocate for banning slavery.
Why ban slavery in the Midwest expansion if he's a slave owner himself?
In his younger years, very much championed the yeoman farmer who would work his own land, even though this did not describe himself. Maybe he was a little bit like St. Thomas Aquinas. Was it Aquinas who said, Lord, make me chaste, just not yet? it's an interesting question, and it's one that, frankly, in the process of making this documentary, I'm looking forward to going down to Charlottesville, just a little south of where I live, and trying to drill down to understand. A lot of the founders, or a number of them, had complex relationship here. Washington freed his slaves in his will. Some of that was implemented, some of it was not. Jefferson, I think, in his early public life, was very progressive. I think as he got older, he sort of backed away and became a little more fatalistic clearly, financially was always dependent on his slaves and became never embraced the abolitionist cause or certainly the free territory cause the way he did as a young man. I believe when the Missouri Compromise controversy was coming up at the end of his life, he did not speak out as forcefully as he did as a young man. I am not enough of a Jefferson expert to explain. I do know that for better or for worse, people's attitudes change over time, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. And that certainly appears to be the case with Thomas Jefferson.
So keep going on the impact of this, though, as a contribution to events that lead up to the Civil War.
So you have this entire region, and one of its very founding principles was that it be free of slavery. And the mindset of the region was very much anti-slavery, and it becomes the hotbed of abolition and by the Underground Railroad as well. Ohio, the very first Old Northwest, or Eastern Midwest, if you will, state, becomes the absolute center of the Underground Railroad. Illinois, land of Lincoln, and so forth. Eventually, then you have the Missouri Compromise, which become almost tears the nation apart. When Missouri comes in as a slave state, it establishes the line, 3630? I believe was supposed to be the dividing line when all the states to the south would be slave and to the north would be free. Then you have the Kansas-Nebraska Act that provided that territories could decide for themselves. That leads to what is known as Bleeding Kansas, where settlers rushed in, Southerners who wanted slavery, abolitionists who wanted to block it, and their was an actual shooting war and dueling legislatures, each one claiming control of the state so that they could then go to Congress and claim that one that was sponsored by Southerners that they could lay claim to actual sovereignty and control and get two pro-slave state senators. And by contrast, that you could have the Northerners or the abolitionists in control. They came to blows, and John Brown himself committed atrocities in what is known in that conflict known as Bleeding Kansas. That was one of the most galvanizing, polarizing events preceding the Civil War. And finally, the Dred Scott decision. Everybody has heard of it. What people may not know is that Dred Scott was a slave who lived, I believe he started off in St. Louis, and he was taken into Illinois by his owner, a free state, and then was taken to Minnesota, I believe, when it was a territory, which was still at the time, I believe, brought in under the Northwest Territory as well. The Southern-controlled Supreme Court said, nope, too bad. The entire Northwest ordinance was unconstitutional. And they struck that down. And that was really one of the absolute straw that broke the camel's back for a lot of folks. All of these events that set the wood, lit the match, and ultimately got Abraham Lincoln elected, and that's what led to secession. By the way, that's why it was literally Lincoln's election. It was not military buildup, anything else. It was the election of a Republican from the North. These are all events that happened in the Midwest. It's not a New Englander getting elected. It's not any lawsuit coming out of New York. These are all events that happened out of the Midwest.
All right, John Locke.
I would add, too, to that, speaking of the Civil War, the actual fighting of the war. Lots of people now are absorbing the new Ron Chernow biography of Ulysses S. Yeah. Grant, which I'm sure Dan is. I've seen him talk about it on Twitter. But Grant symbolizes what the Midwest did for the Northern cause during the Civil War. Grant and fellow generals General Sherman, of course, they were the two key Union generals to winning the war. And the commander-in-chief was Lincoln from nearby where Grant grew up in Illinois. And the amount of men and material and industrial strength that they could bring to the war made it, in the end, possible for the North to prevail. The North had enough problems as it was. Just think if they didn't have the industrial brawn and all those young farm boys from the Midwest to do the fighting, they probably would have lost.
All right, here's my big question for you. How come we don't know our history? How come we don't know tribal history? How come we don't know Midwestern history? Why is there such a gap right now?
Well, we have many problems writ large with historical knowledge. But we have a particularly acute problem here in the Midwest because our voice hasn't been very strong in the history profession. It's been declining for many decades. Our states in the Midwest don't emphasize enough its own history, unlike other regions in the South where there's a great deal of attention given to Southern history in the schools. Our big universities in the Midwest have dropped the ball in terms of teaching the history of the Midwest. Universities in the South have institutes for studying their region. They have many professors who teach about the region, but you can't find people who teach the history of the Midwest at Big Ten universities. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the most important things that we need to change to revive the field. But yes, in overall, we're doing a very poor job of educating the young in terms of history. Someone posted on Twitter a few weeks ago what a typical history exam was for a young student in Indiana in the year 1900. And these were very detailed, specific questions about what you had to know to be to pass a class in American history 100 years ago. And nobody could pass that test now. But we need to get back to that age when we took our history a little bit seriously. It would improve our civic affairs immensely.
Let's jump ahead, Dan, and there's a couple more topics that we have to cover here, and one of them is the populist movement.
Yeah, it's interesting. The past presidential election, the word populist and populism was batted about. I'm not sure if people really know exactly what it means in the context of 2017, but as a historical movement, it obviously was a very important moment in time, and it emanated, of course, out of the South to an extent, but in large part in the Plain States and in the Midwest. And the populist movement of the 1880s and 1890s, and its zenith when the People's Party fielded presidential candidates and I believe took four maybe states in the presidential election, had a major impact on not just the region, but influencing some of the politics of the United States. You can still see some of its echoes in some of the co-ops and other policies here in the region. Of course, my favorite, I know there's some debate about this, but I think it's hard to dispute that The Wizard of Oz is a parable about American populism and the populist movement and so forth. But to the extent that America right now is trying to work through how the various factions of American society and the regions are getting along, I think it's instructive to see how the prairie and plains populists of the 1880s and 1890s broke through and really got their voices heard. It's an incredible story that is just utterly forgotten.
You mentioned during the most recent presidential election that word is batted about. What is the connection then between the populist movement of the 1880s and 1890s and 2016, 2017?
Well, populism can mean many different things in many different contexts, but if you want to really boil it down, it means, you know, the broad class of people against the interests or the establishment or the people in power. And back in the 1890s, when they were writing the famous Omaha Platform and William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska was campaigning as a populist, they were taking on the Eastern establishment in the form of railroad owners and Eastern financiers, et cetera. The 2016 version of that is Trump attacking the existing establishment in Washington for being, you know, stuck in their ways and not changing, and he needs to drain the swamp, et cetera. So it can take different forms at different times, but it generally means the people writ large versus the establishment in power.
Fair connection, do you think, in knowing the history that you do, when people were using that word and making some of those connections, was it accurate and fair?
In the 1890s, do you mean?
In the recent election, when they were using some of the things from the 1890s, was it a fair connection or was it just overdrawn?
Well, I think there's definitely a parallel there. I mean, the drain the swamp metaphor is something that all populists have used going back to the beginning of time. Back when Dan was talking about the early republic and the revolutionary era, these settlers out on the frontier in western Pennsylvania and then eastern Ohio, they were always attacking the coastal elites that controlled the colonies. And those were very legitimate complaints because, you know, the landed gentry that ran the colonies and owned most of the colonies were definitely the establishment. And the people out on the frontier were often subject to their whims and had no authority or power or influence. And that's why what happened after the revolution was so amazing for them, because all of a sudden they had a say in the state of affairs and in elections, and they could get people into Congress. And so, yeah, I think it's a fair parallel, but obviously it's a slippery one.
What's next?
Well, we're reaching out to various historical organizations, and we're going to be talking to the humanities councils of the Midwestern states, as well as public television stations throughout the region, to gauge interest, as well as some of the stakeholders that we're hoping to engage back in on the East Coast. I'm going to be talking to folks at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and so forth. Then, of course, there's always the joy of fundraising. So we will be talking to foundations back here in the Midwest. And there I'm actually very hopeful. Philanthropic sector in the Midwest is vibrant and engaged. I think this is the type of thing a number of them will be very interested in, recognize that this is an undertold story. In fact, I spoke with somebody at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, PBS, who said as much to me back in the spring. So I'm optimistic that we're going to get financial support, programming support for that. John and I are going to be discussing. We have an outline in progress that will be turning into a treatment, and then a very rough early script, as you do for these documentaries. At that point, we start doing some heavy archival work to find the visuals, the old photos and so forth. Mm-hmm. In some cases, that'll be an interesting challenge, because when you're trying to come up with visuals for things that happened back in the 1800s or even the 1700s, that can always be an interesting challenge. But this, as John mentioned, this will be sort of a mix of a Ken Burns style documentary with stills, dramatic and historical readings, period music and thematic music, as well as there will be a number of segments, interviews with some interesting scholars, and hopefully some celebrities and just interesting representative citizens from the various states reflecting on the Midwest, not just the history, but also the region, what it means to them, and so forth. So development, raise the money, gather the research, and then start shooting.
The potential impact of something like, of a project like this long-term.
Well, I think it will raise the level of historical consciousness in the region. I think one of the impacts will be a lot more people learning about their roots and maybe digging down and doing their own research and writing some books. And I think we are only better off when people understand their basic roots and their identity. And it makes a strong contribution to civic affairs. One of the arrows we have in our quiver that Dan sort of alluded to is the strength of Midwestern historical societies. We can draw on places like the Wisconsin Historical Society. The Indiana Historical Society, where I was a few weeks ago, is an amazing institution. But these institutions are very much siloed off, and they don't really talk to one another, and they don't really think in terms of region very much. They often really focus on their state, which makes sense. But I think if we can move them a little bit conceptually to think about the region a little bit more, we can get them cooperating. And we're going to try and do that at meetings like the Midwestern History Association meeting this summer in Michigan on June 6th at Grand Valley State. That's where a lot of these conversations will take place, and hopefully we can do some interviews for the documentary.
Dan, any final thoughts on the potential impact of it? What's your vision for a project like this? What are your hopes?
Well, you know, I think above all, Midwesterners deserve to be very proud. They should be very proud of their history. They should be very proud to be Midwesterners. One of our favorite books, John, help me. What is it? American Regions. What's the book by our friend Colin? American Nations.
Yeah.
American Nations.
Colin Woodard.
Yes,
he's a reporter at the Portland newspaper in Maine,
and he divides American into various distinct nations, as he calls them, and he rightly, in my view, describes the. I think he calls it the Midlands or the Midwestern nation as really laying greatest claim to what is sort of the predominant American identity. Not only do I think that's true, but I think once this project is done, Midwesterners will see they have not only contributed to American history, they really have had an absolutely premier contribution to making America what it is today. And I think they can feel, even though it's not very Midwestern to feel pride, hopefully they will feel an incredible sense of pride and tell coastal elitists like me, you know, to buzz off, because, you know, it is one of the greatest place in America with the greatest people in America and the greatest history in America.
There's a complexity to it, too. When you mentioned Ken Burns and the Vietnam Project that we recently watched over the summer, there's a shameful history as well, too. And we certainly have that as well.
No question about it. And we not going to be Pollyannish, not going to put on rose-colored glasses. We're certainly going to talk about that. And it is admittedly a massive project. To accommodate that, there will be a major component of it that will be online. We're only going to be able to tackle so much in the documentary. There will be a lot of this that will be in an online component. But, you know, knowledge is power, and gives you quite a sense of identity, and I think Midwesterners and Americans will discover that it's flyover history is history well worth knowing.
Dan, John, thank you so
much
for
Lori.
Coming in. We'll follow this project as it moves along.
Thank you so much.